Hello and welcome to Mission Artist. Today we are speaking with composer, conductor, musician Gregory Smith. Now, if you're a Disney fan or watch ESPN, CBS, or you're a Trekkie, you will have heard Gregory's work. In addition to all this, Gregory has composed a series of magnificent narrated orchestral pieces created for Young People's Concerts, or YPCs. These are family and education-oriented concerts that have their roots with the New York Philharmonic going back to 1914, but they really came to their apex with Leonard Bernstein when he became music director of the Phil, and CBS broadcasted these concerts from 1958 to 1972. When we originally talked, I hadn't realized it, and I think you were sort of leading to it. Because of your connection to Marin, you guys have a direct lineage to these New York Phil Young Persons Concerts.
We do, and let me first thank you for interviewing me. It's an honor.
Oh, sure.
The connection is via Marin Alsop, who was one of Bernstein's last protégés, who kind of grabbed the torch from him. She had been, I think, duly impressed as a young girl growing up in New York with musician parents, and she had seen Leonard conduct and had been inspired at that point. And though she studied violin for years and years and years, there was always the allure of being a conductor. And Lenny was certainly her go-to source of inspiration. And interestingly, when she got to college, and she mentioned wanting to be a conductor, and a particular professor said, women don't do that.
Really?
And Marin went home and told her parents this, I think in particular her father, Lamar, a violinist, by the way, her mom, a cellist, and I had the pleasure of working with both of them too. The next day she, I think, came to the breakfast table. I think I had these details correct. And her father had bought her a box of batons, and he said, yes, they do.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
So Marin eventually studied with Leonard Bernstein at notable at Tanglewood, where I think she won the Koussevitzky Award. And off it went. It was a nice relationship. And from the moment I met Marin, which was as a session player, I was doing music in New York City those days, and she would be the contractor for the strings and the concertmaster. So as strange as it seems to me now, I used to conduct her. And trust me, there was always a click track, and it was fairly easy on the conducting side, just cutoffs and dynamics and things. But so off she went with this conducting career that was emerging with the, you know, the push from Leonard Bernstein. She became music director of the Eugene Symphony. I think that was her first definite post as the leader of the symphony. She had been guesting up until that point, doing all those things that emerging conductors do, which is, as you know, educational concerts, family concerts, pops concerts, covering, all those sorts of things. And she called me up one day, and I knew her conducting coming alive. And she called me up and she said, Greg, I'm tired of doing Peter and the Wolf and Young Person's Guide and fine works, you know, they're great pieces. And she said, I need something new. And she said, why don't you write one? And so I thought about it. First of all, I didn't know what a YPC was, a young person's concert work. I didn't know what that was. So I had to acquaint myself with it. And she said, if you write it, I'll do two performances with the Eugene Symphony this coming fall. I think this was late spring. And I thought about it. I thought about, okay. For me, the enticement was to write for a live orchestra, full orchestra. Up until that point, I really hadn't done anything for a live orchestra, just studio orchestras, which is a little different animal than the live setting, and very often smaller groups too. So this was a big draw for me to be asked to write for a symphony orchestra that had guaranteed performances, in this case too. That's all I thought about. I thought, well, the payoff will be I get to hear an orchestra play my stuff. It required narrator, which young people's concert works often do to kind of bridge the gap between understanding and the music itself. So I wrote a piece and took the old familiar adage, write what you know. And I thought, well, if I'm going to spend the time on this piece, it better be something that holds me long enough to get through it so I can complete it. So I had an idea about the process, writing a piece about the process of composing music, one composer's method of composing music, which happened to be my own. And so I called it Mr. Smith's Composition. And it wasn't because my name was Smith, although it probably somewhere under the surface is, but it was more about permission for anyone to write music. anyone mean Smith is a generic name. You know, that's like your everyman kind of name. So I wanted to make the point that, just to digress for a moment, I grew up in a small town in Ohio where composers were people from Europe. And they had names I couldn't pronounce, let alone spell. And I didn't feel like I was entitled to become a composer. And I suffered from a small town inferiority complex even through college. And it wasn't until I got to New York and was dwarfed by everything that was going on there that I started to mix in with some fine musicians, you know, in the recording field. And I realized, you know what? I feel like I belong here, at least to a comfortable extent. And so I kind of broke my pattern of feeling inferior. But when I got the chance to write this piece, I wanted it to be friendly and accessible so that other people could, if they wanted to, could pursue music. And the other part of it, and this is from Marin and ultimately from Bernstein, it was to bring the whole classical music experience, especially concert stage with this, you know, the symphony and the suits and the dresses and black and all that formality, trying to bring it down to earth, trying to bring it down where people could see that these are real human beings that play music. You know, you yourself, you devoted your life to your instrument, but I'll bet you have other interests, right? Your interests are very broad. And for a fourth, fifth, or sixth grader sitting in the audience, they might want to play an instrument badly, passionately, but they may not want to give their whole life away because that's what it appears they might have to do. So it's to make it accessible, friendly, and to show that the people on that are playing this music so brilliantly, yes, they've devoted a lot of time, but they also live lives. They have other aspects to their lives.
I just want to insert this thought that came up because this is the second time I'm actually interviewing you, because the first time was this project that you did with Chris Confessori and Brevard, which was the student composer project, which is very much like what you're saying about how you wanted Mr. Smith's composition to be like. And I think that was a great project. It was the perfect way to sort of, as you would say, make it accessible to everyone, and that it's not something that just belongs to a certain group of people. The potential is there for everybody. And I think that is at the heart of what Bernstein was doing with his concerts. And I think what you've brought to the young person's concert literature.
Well, thank you. That's gratifying to hear that. By the way, that student composer project, just to detail it a little bit, I came down on an isolated visit. There weren't any concerts involved, and met with, I think it was fifth and sixth graders, at local schools. And it required some organization from the music departments to kind of pick which schools and which teachers could probably pull it off. The kids wrote melodic ideas, some rhythmic ideas. I visited with them and we brought them together into a piece. And each school represented a movement in the overall work. So we called it a suite. And it was really very rewarding. And the biggest, I'm definitely older now, but I've been not so old that I don't remember having been in grade school, how I would have felt to hear a symphony orchestra play four bars of something I wrote, or the melody that I can see. I would be crazy over that. That would be a big motivating factor and springboard for me. So I tried to remember that when I met with the students. It's good to know that people write music. Real live people write music. Real live people play music, right? And that's not always obvious, unfortunately, to the masses. So I'd like to think that I'm trying to make that clear. And with Marin's push, it definitely has been rewarding. Mr. Smith's Bowl of Notes is about the 12 notes. Did you guys play that? Did we?
Yes, that was the first concert we did with you.
Oh, that's right, at the Opera House there. I remember that. That's a challenging piece because it's a historical piece that covers 400 years of Western music in I don't know, 28 minutes or something. And, you know, that's a lot of ground to cover, and I certainly gave short shrift of certain composers. But you know, the whole point of my educational concert works is, yeah, they have to teach, right? They have to be educational by definition. That's why we're all together. But the last thing I want is for the students to have this big field trip that they've been prepared for, that they looked for, to find out that the concert hall turns out to be the world's largest classroom. You know, I don't want to double cross and say, well, we got you here now. Now, this is an oboe. The practical matter that I've always tried to engage is that I try to distract them with story or with entertainment, hopefully some jokes that land. And when they're not looking, when they're distracted, we teach them.
These works do that beautifully. Do you have other people come in and do the narration when they perform it, or is it usually?
That's a good question, Chico. I was just with you guys in Sarasota. It was a glorious week of 9 performances culminating in that family concert Friday night. Oh my gosh. Oh, it was just wonderful. That's very practical to have me in because there's several performances within a very short period of time. Some orchestras will do a performance 1 week and then it'll be off for 2 weeks. It's not practical. Also, just the logistics and budgets and things like that that put me out, fly me in. Some orchestras, they have cheaper ways out, and I'm all for it. In fact, I'd have to say most often I do not narrate the performances.
So we've been really lucky because I think you're a magic ingredient in all of this.
Well, thank you. And Sarasota is a special place. I mean, how many people did we reach 2 weeks ago?
I don't know the numbers, but I mean, it was a lot of people and lots of kids. But the first time that we culminated with that family concert, that was the kind of feedback, that we have been missing during the pandemic. And it's like, yeah, the kids are great and the screaming is overwhelming. But when you get the kids and the parents screaming together, that was the antidote to COVID.
Just so your listeners know, we did a piece that is called The Animated Orchestra. The Animated Orchestra is about a cartoon that's going to be shown at a concert with the composer there to, to guide them through it while the orchestra plays the music live for the cartoon. Oh, that sounds reasonable. Unfortunately, the cartoon doesn't get there, which leaves us with the predicament of what to do. Just to cut to the chase here, without the visuals, we have the audience. I describe the scenes, the orchestra plays the music, and the audience imagines what happens in the cartoon, which is about a ferret that invades a musical instrument repair shop and then eventually gets stuck in a tuba, ends up on the concert stage of the symphony concert, at which time the orchestra, which you were part of, reenacts to the best of their ability what happens in the cartoon along with the conductor. And it gets pretty zany and pretty wacky. And the best part is the kids are involved. It turns out that it should be no surprise to me. It certainly isn't now. Younger audiences like that love to participate. So in the case of the Animated Orchestra, it's about a ferret. A ferret has a lot of wonderful comical characteristics. Nature. It came from nature. I didn't invent them. A ferret comes with all those attached. But one of the sounds it makes is duck, 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 duck. So because the cartoon's missing not only the visuals, but of course the sound effects, the kids have to provide the ducking effect. And you know very well when there's snoring required, which is the repair shop owner's, he's an older gentleman that sleeps a lot. And so we lean on the orchestra to provide the snoring sound effect. So everybody's involved.
Interestingly enough, the Animated Orchestra has an origin story from another family concert run that featured a work that would inspire a main character.
Early on, when I was doing concerts with Marin, she became the music director of the Long Island Philharmonic, where I lived. I lived on Long Island and still worked with her in New York. But she had me in to do educational concerts occasionally, and she would need me to narrate something other than what I'd written. I think she did Two Oilish People, Merry Pranks. She wrote her own narration, and I delivered it. And another time, she performed a Scott Bradley Tom and Jerry score to the cartoon, to picture. And it was missing all sound, so she needed someone to stand on stage and make the sound effects. And of course, I was part of the concert, so she involved me in that. And I didn't forget that, because it was fun, being the doctor, doing all that kind of crazy stuff. So years later, she became the music director of the Cabrillo Festival of Contemporary Music in Santa Cruz, a very successful contemporary music festival that I had been part of probably 10 or 12 times over the years as the family concert slot on a Sunday. And I premiered, 4 or 5 of my pieces there. So it was, it was their 20th anniversary. They commissioned me to write a new educational concert work. And I remember this experience I had had with Marin with Tom and Jerry cartoon making the sound effects. So I decided to maybe commemorate that memory with this cartoon-oriented piece, the Animated Orchestra. And she did it and premiered it, and she really liked it. We were walking off stage, and I realized the audience was applauding, thankfully. The orchestra was laughing at the audience. They were cheering the audience. And Marin and I are walking off, and I turned to Marin and I said, Marin, who's the audience and who's the performer here? It was blurred. the line was blurred. And I thought, what could be better than that?
Nothing. That's ideally what we're trying to do.
When you're playing Beethoven, though, you don't let the crowd go on.
No. We always have other types of things that happen. We read the audience differently during performances like this. But yeah, ideally, we want to get back to what you're saying. Yeah. And just even this idea of clapping in between movements, I don't have a problem with that. That's an honest reaction. And that was really just something that got picked up formally.
I wanted to ask you, since you are a player in the orchestra, even if there aren't sounds being made by the audience, you must have a sense of how they feel about what you're doing. Maybe it's the applause you received in the last gap when you...
If you're sensitive enough, you can feel them reacting. And you can feel the change of the energy. And when they're really into something, there might be a 3 or 4 second gap before they react, but you know they loved it or they hated it. So,
But knowing that audience is out there, you're kind of gunning for it. So back to the animated orchestra, after we've done 8 educational concerts, which were fun and kind of a riot. I mean, there was some lively moments in there, but I modeled a piece after Warner Brothers cartoons where there's layers of humor. And some of the humor is a little higher brow than some of the lightweight, obvious stuff. And the kids get all the lightweight stuff, some of the other things. But when we finally hit our stride with that 9th family concert where parents and kids, before I came out, you know, I was backstage and I realized there's a lot of people there. The 1,740-seat auditorium, I suppose it was 3/4 full. I mean, there's a lot of people there. And so I knew that, and then I heard the response to what was being played before me when the instruments were introduced. Everyone's cheering for the instrument. Well, and I'm thinking, oh, we got a lively one. And I went out there, and sure enough, and they just give it back. And then all of you guys, the orchestra members, you're asked to do many non-musical, extra musical things, right? And you feed on the laughter. And you've done it all week long. You guys went overboard with it, and it was great. It was so fulfilling to see this go on and see the audience just eating it up.
Absolutely. And I think musicians were all sort of like, what do you call it, applause whores. So I think it was funny because I was talking to one of the trombone players. I was telling him, you guys, I never knew how well you guys screamed. And he said, well, thank you. I did that for my son. He was so bummed he couldn't come to the concert. So I told him, I will scream and stop really loud for you.
I love that. Yeah. And you all personalize the moments I've asked you to go outside music. You do. It's different every orchestra.
I think we all have a very close relationship with Ari. I know I do. I love
Ari
that
the
weasel.
Ferret, right? Yeah,
Ari,
yeah.
Ari the ferret.
Oh, I'm glad you feel that way about Ari. It was just really gratifying. It was as much fun as I could have on stage with an orchestra, and I'm just happy to be involved.
For Smith, the creative process in writing these family concert pieces differ from his usual studio. And he gives thanks to Alsop for her support, guidance, and inspiration.
Early on, when she was this emerging conductor and asked me to write the first one, I had questions because I didn't know what an educational concert work really was. It was about it, practical things like instrumentation, what not to write for, don't put a piano in it, you'll limit performances, whatever, things like that. And at the time, everything I was doing, I had someone looking over my shoulder. I was doing commercials or TV news themes, and I always had a lot of people telling me what they wanted me to do, what they didn't like. I was being scrutinized, and that's fine. That worked for hire. Everybody knows something about music. So when Marin asked me to do this, I was the boss. But I tried to turn to her. I said, you know, I came up with the idea for to be about a process of composing music, and I felt obligated to run it by her because she had asked me to write the piece. And I called her up and I said, well, is this what it's about? And she said, oh, I'm sure it'll be fine. That's what she said to me. And I was shocked, of course, because I felt obligated to bring her up to speed and she didn't require it. So I had carte blanche, as long as it was educational and wasn't strange in some way. It was a Saturday morning and I wouldn't call her with one question. I'd call her if I had a few or, you know, 4 or 5. And I finally had enough questions to call her up. And I called her a Saturday morning and she wasn't there. I left her a message. Marin, I have some questions about the piece. Whenever you get a chance, just give me a call. It wasn't a hurry at all. So she called me. It was shortly after 6 o'clock that evening. She was always good about getting back. And I said, "Hey, Marin, thanks for calling back. I didn't expect to hear from you on a Saturday night." She goes, "Yeah, I know you have some questions about the piece, but is it going to take very long?" I knew she was coming up in the world. So I was curious. I said, "My friend, I want to know what she was up to. It was Saturday night. What's going on?" You know, and I said, "Well, no, this can wait till another time, but what, you have something going on?" She goes, "Well, I'm about to make my New York Philharmonic debut." It was one of those occasions when you take the phone away from your face and you look at it and you say, "Why are you calling me now?" This is one of those things. I always refer to her as my angel. If you back up to before I was writing arrangements and stuff, she had come out to my house in Brooklyn to play on a short film. I actually hired another violinist from the Radio City Orchestra who's going to bring a cellist out. I was doing a score for a little short film, and I had enough money, you know, to pay each of them $75 for 2 hours. That was the budget for the movie. Movie's music was $150. And so I wrote this little ghost, little scary score. I wanted those two strings to play. It kind of worked for me. And this Radio City musician said she'd come out on a Saturday and bring a cellist. And I said, "Okay, great." She decided she wanted the weekend off. So she sent Marin. And Marin came out with a cellist named Eugene Moy. Very fine cellist. Whew. So I had the two of them in my place, a little four-track recorder. We recorded for 2 hours. It went fine. We're sitting around having coffee afterwards. And Marin says, "So what do you do for a living?" Well, she knew it wasn't doing short films. And she looked over. She saw I had a drafting table where I'd been doing some copying work. And so I said, "Well, you know, I do music prep. I can copy when there's projects to do. And, you know, sometimes I arrange if there's overflow." And she said, "Give me your card." I gave her the card, and 2 weeks later, I got a call from a music production house in New York City that needed something copied overnight. And it was for $500, which to me at the time was a fortune. And it was crazy, crazy work to get it done that quickly.
Can you explain what that means, copy?
Copying. Well, with music, there's a composer who very often will orchestrate it, assign all the parts for the orchestra. Musicians like yourself, you don't read the entire score. Each individual instrument's part needs to be taken out of that score. And literally, like a monk with a candle, we have lights. You know, you sit there with an ink pen. At the time, it was all ink. It wasn't done in computers. Those weren't happening yet. And you're a scribe. You take that one line off the entire arrangement, and that's the cello part in your case. And then you do that for all the instruments. So it's tedious, really voluminous work. And it's an entry point, usually for arrangers, because, for instance, I worked for this music house that she recommended me to, and I found some mistakes. Well, that's not unusual, but the guy I was working for made note of it. And so he gave me some arranging opportunities. Next thing you know it, I'm not copying it anymore. I'm writing it, or, you know, arranging and writing it, at which time Marin started to fill out my string sections and, you know, acted as concert master and contractor. So I started to work with her. She put me on the map with the first music house I worked with in New York, and that expanded to the point where I eventually had a little one myself. So go back before the educational concert works. She helped me out then too. Things were going pretty well, and I wanted to thank her. So I said, let me take you lunch or something. And she said, "Well, I have a session and we break from such and such time." And I go, "Okay, I'll come by. We'll go find some." I would have taken her to the Four Seasons. I swear. She had done that much for me. And we walk across the street from the studio into this little Spanish bodega. We each have like a tuna melt, and $8 later, I fulfilled my lunch obligation. She's very down to earth and focused on what is important to her, which is making music. It's just been a wonderful relationship, and so grateful. I can track so much of what I do now, including sitting here speaking with you, to her.
We owe her a great debt of gratitude for really recognizing what you could do with these compositions. And I was really excited when you had mentioned that connection to Marin, because I realized, okay, there's that direct lineage. It's a great story. I understand why you really wanted to focus in on that, because it's a testament just to the fact that you can follow a certain traditional path as a composer, but you were given this opportunity by someone who was not restricted by, you know, you need to have done this and done that. And then all of a sudden you discover just how rich your choices are. And I think that's fantastic. And we are so lucky now to have this body of work that you've created for young people's concerts, because they're just the right mix to sort of make it accessible for everybody.
That's a good point. And also to just underscore that emphasis, it's accessible. Sometimes we sit back and say, we, the conductor and I, we sit back, I wonder how many players in the audience will consider a string instrument. I wonder how many will play in the marching band. You guys inspire it, and they see you doing this, and it's in a more casual setting. It's so much more human. I like to think we're showing them the way or helping them know that if that's what they want to do, do it.
And at the same time, you offer music not to build replacements for the orchestra, but just for people to have a fuller life and have options and to find other things that make you happy.
Exactly. And sad but true fact is a lot of the educational concerts, it's sometimes going to be the only time that those people hear a symphony orchestra live. But the good news is there's orchestras and movie scores. And lots of TV shows, but in the movie scores in particular. And Mr. John Williams put that sound of the orchestra in so many people's ears. I think it's been a huge benefit. I think, anyway.
I will confess what got me into music was Star Wars.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that.
You did. And also Close Encounters, because I really liked how different that score was. And so that got me very excited about the different kinds of music. And it's just like, it's so different from Star Wars.
Close Encounters is a high watermark score for me. And he writes great themes. He always has. But if you look at the score to Close Encounters, it's an anthology of contemporary musical composition. Ligeti, there's all kinds of stuff. Penderecki in there. It's all in there. And it's all done really well and effective depiction. So I'm a big...
And I had no idea what I was listening to. I just thought, oh, that's really cool. Yes.
He moved you. He moved.
He did. He did.
I had one experience with him when NBC redid their theme. They redid it for the digital age, so it all had to be re-recorded. And I was friends with the music supervisor that was overseeing it. And he came out here and he did it with a big orchestra on a Sunday. And I got to spend 7 hours behind the console with my producer friend. Well, John Williams re-recorded all that. And this guy was in his glory. You'd think he'd be jaded by this point? Oh, no. No, no. At one point, I asked him, I said, he came back, you know, every 50 minutes, they take 10-minute break. So that 10 minutes was usually sitting next to Sean Murphy, the engineer, and in front of the producer. And I said, we talk a bit. He was just fired up, and it came in so well prepared. They wanted an extra theme. Tom Brokaw had gone off the air, but he was still doing a special. And they needed a theme for Tom Brokaw. John Williams came in with two. I had tons of respect for him before, but seeing him in his glory, working, enjoying every second of it, that's over the top now. I'm glad he inspired you too.
Yes. Bernstein's stuff was before me. So the stuff that I was listening to, it was John Williams and it was a lot of TV.
Yeah. It was Star Trek. God bless them. They used fairly full orchestras. It was most often there were six French horns.
Well, I did see that video of you re-recording the original, what is it, Alexander Courage one?
Yeah, the original Star Trek theme. I met someone at Paramount who oversaw marketing for them. He had come to a Star Trek session, and so he asked me to re-record that, the original one, William Shatner, and I thought, wow, that's a big honor. And I went to the library, they pulled the scores, the library at Paramount, they pulled the scores. It was the original pencil scores. And there's Alexander Courage's name. And I thought, well, you know what? He should come in and conduct. He was elderly, but I knew he was still around. He had students. And so I tried desperately to find him. Various people, and someone said, he's probably off at a music festival somewhere. And I never heard back in time. So I conducted it. It was a real honor because my older brother and I, we used to watch Friday nights, those, you know, try to figure out which star is going to be the Enterprise when it comes in the opening. But there it was, you know, and Sony and a soundstage, and it was really nice.
So at this point, I'm totally geeking out, so indulge me for a few minutes. For years, I assumed, like Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory, that the haunting melody of the original theme was played on an electronic instrument called the theremin, and that's partially correct as it was used for later seasons. But the true, original scored version of the theme was vocal, and the Paramount remastering that Smith conducted sticks to the score.
Interesting story about that singer. Her name is Elin Carlson, and she's sung tons of movies in choirs and things, and she's a very, very good singer. She happens to be a Trekkie. And when I called her, obviously, she was so excited to do it. Someone had put me in touch with her and said, you need to hire her. Production-wise, we put her in an isolated room. And it was just off the control room, and I was in the big room with the orchestra where you want the liveness of the room to be in. So, but you want to be able to control her. So we made sure she was isolated. She decorated the room, the vocal room, with tribbles. I swear, she had tribbles all over the place. And we did take after take after take of this thing. And because I'm out in the room, I kind of forgot about her. And she sang it the same way. She was so good and so committed, too. That it was a really nice event for me in many ways. But that show, thank God, maintained high production values with the orchestra. There was always enough strings. It wouldn't be a symphonic size string section, but there was always enough instruments so it sounded orchestral. And that's all credit to Paramount, the producers, to make sure that it had high production value.
Thank you for joining us for our interview with composer Gregory Smith. If you'd like to learn more about Smith's other family concert works and current media projects, you can visit his webpage at gregorysmithmusic.com. This episode wraps up Season 2 of Mission Artist. Keep an eye out for special episodes and Season 3 announcements on our social media and website, and safe travels and adventures this summer.